Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Torah Studies. This is another edition of our Wild and Woolly class. I don't know how woolly it is. It's the summer, but it's nonetheless always fun. Right. Always fun. We're studying the Torah portion from a deeper perspective. So today, we talk about fear and how to combat fear. When I say fear, there's different types of fear, but I mean fear in the sense of being afraid to take on something new, to take on a new project, a new idea, a new direction in life, you know, a new initiative. Anytime we're embarking on something new and we're faced with fear that's holding us back from starting that new thing, so tonight's class is going to hopefully address that. Three meditations to address and quiet a little bit the fears that we might have inside. So let's begin by opening up the Chumash to the Torah portion. Torah portion this week is Shelach, and it pertains to... glad you have it. It pertains to the story of the spies. In the Chumash, it begins on page 940, 941. I would say that this is one of the more famous stories of the Torah, where the Torah tells us, as the Jews are getting ready, they're prepared to enter the land of Israel, so they ask, they request from Moshe to send spies to check out the land. Moshe acquiesces, they go in, and disaster ensues. Today we're going to focus on a verse and a half that is easily missed in the whole analysis, in the whole story of the spies. We're talking about one verse, maybe a verse and a half, that is so subtle, you might just not even pay attention. And yet it holds incredible insight, incredible wisdom, not only for then, but for us today as well. So let's explore. So Moshe chooses 12 spies. Let's read the intro. Ray, please get us started. Chapter 13 of the Book of Numbers, page 941 of the Gunnig edition, Shlach.
God spoke to Moshe saying, send out men for yourself to explore the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the children of Israel. Send one man for each paternal tribe. Each one should be a leader among them.
12 tribes, 12 leaders, 12 spies. Continue.
Moshe sent them by the word of God from the desert of Haran. All of them were men of distinction. They were the heads of the children of Israel.
Now, we're going to skip the names, but the Torah then proceeds to list all the names of the 12 tribal leaders. Let's turn to page 943. Let's pick it up with verse 16, please. 1, 2, 3, the fourth line down from the top of 943, where it says, these were the names.
These were the names of the men Moshe sent to explore the land. Moshe called Hosea, the son of Nun, Yehoshua.
So the Torah tells us that one of the spies, whose name was Hosea, was changed to Yehoshua, and the Torah kind of just leaves it at that and doesn't explain, but we'll see soon that that's very significant. Please continue.
Moshe sent them to explore the land of Canaan. He said to them, go up this way along the south border until you reach the sea, and then go up the west coast until you reach Hamath, which is by the Hor Mountain. See what kind of land it is. Are the people who inhabit it strong or weak? Are there a few of them or many? How is the land which they inhabit? Does it have good springs and wells or bad ones? How are the cities in which they live? Are they in unenclosed cities or in fortresses? What is the soil like? Is it fertile or barren? Are there any righteous people there who are like trees that protect the people or not? Be courageous and take some of the land's fruit. It was the season when the first grapes ripened.
Okay, so this is Moshe's charge to the spies. go to the land and do all of these things and bring back some of the fruit. Hey, if you're going somewhere, listen, no, you know, a Jewish meeting always has food, and whenever you get sent on a mission, it's always, and bring back some food, right? It's always like, oh, you're going there, you know what, bring me back some, or there's always some a food element. So he asked for the fruit. It's very interesting, all the details that he asked for, but that's that was the charge. Now, the Torah continues to tell us that the spies went, and indeed, they toured the land, they came back. They came back and they brought back a very interesting report. Okay, take a look at 9:45. Turn the page, please, to 9:45, where it says the spies report. Ray, please read that in the middle of the page, 9:45.
At the end of 40 days, they returned from scouting the land. They went with bad intentions, and their intentions were so bad when they came to Moshe and Aharon and the entire congregation of the children of Israel in Kadesh in the desert of Paran. They brought them back a report to Moshe and Aharon, as well as to the entire congregation, and they showed them the land's fruit. They reported to Moshe and said, "We came to the land to which she sent us. It is flowing with milk and honey, and this is its fruit."
So far, so good, right? The land's great, flowing with milk and honey, and large fruit. Continue 9:47, and here the other shoe drops.
However, the people who live in the land are extraordinarily powerful. The cities are huge and well fortified, and we even saw the children of a giant there. Amalek lives in the south of the land. The Hittites, Jebusites, and Amorites live in the mountains, and the Canaanites live both on the coast and alongside the Jordan.
Okay, so let's stop right here. Okay, so we have here the mission, the stated goal of the mission, the charge of the mission. The spies go out, they come back, and they say, look, the land is wonderful, flowing with milk and honey. However, people are powerful, the cities are fortified, and you have all of these enemies, all of these dangerous nations and peoples that are living in the land that we are meant to conquer. Okay. As the story goes, this sows fear into the hearts of the people to the point that they cry out to God and say, God, why are you trying to kill us? Don't you love us? Why are you killing us? You're taking us into a suicidal mission. And God says famously, if you don't want to go into the land, fine, you won't. Not today, not tomorrow, and not for the rest of your life. This entire generation, God says, will die, will perish before entering the land, 4 years. Not that they'll be killed with a sudden plague, but rather they will die natural causes. So it's going to take 40 years for the youngest, for the 20-year-olds or whatever it is, for the younger ones to pass on. And at the end of 4 years, your children, the next generation, they will be the ones to finally enter the land of Israel. With the exception of two spies. Famously, we know that there were only 10, not only, 10 spies out of 12 were the ones that brought back the negative report. There were two that did not. Who were they?
Caleb and Joshua.
Caleb and Joshua. Joshua, Yoshua, we know what his special merit was. What was it? Moshe changed his name. Remember you read? It says, God, Moshe changed his name from Hoshea to Yehoshua, which stands for Ka, Yoshiacha Me'atzat Meraglim. May God save you from the plot, from the advice of the other spies. So Moshe blessed Joshua that he should be saved from the negative intentions of the spies. By the way, if Moshe knew that the spies had negative intentions before he sent them, why did he send them? That's another question for another time. But the point is that Moshe sent them. He was suspicious. He blessed Joshua. How did Caleb, how was he strong? So let's jump into the Torah studies text. Yes. Yeah, the air conditioner is on. You know, it's on. It's not kicking in as much as it could. You could do that. It creates a strobe effect. It's a little bit disjoint. Yeah.
Oh, but it's comfortable now.
I know everyone's got their own temperature gauges. I would say, let's leave it because I think that's... There you go. That's why Steve is here. Okay, let's jump in. Marnine, please get us started. Please open up your Torah Studies textbooks or the pamphlets to page 189. 189, text 2a. This is a text from the Chumash. We skipped this. I skipped this intentionally. I didn't want to read it in the Chumash because this translation is too much commentary, and this is a more straightforward translation that's going to help us derive what we need to derive. Marnin.
They went up in the south, and he came to Hebron. And there were Amon, Shishai, and Talmai, the descendants of the giant. Now Hebron built 7 years before
Zon
of Egypt.
Okay, and so it gives us a lot of details there with names and giants and whatever. The point I want to focus on and what Rashi points out is the inconsistency in the first line of that text. They went up, the spies, went up to the south and he came to Hebron. What? They all went to the south, but only he went to Hebron? Who's he? So the commentaries say, who is he? Who is he? Is actually Hebrew. Who is he? And he is she. Text 2b.
And he came to Hebron. Caleb went there alone. Hence the synagogue he came. To prostrate himself on the graves of the patriarchs in prayer that he not be enticed by his colleagues to be part of their council. Thus it says, I will give him Caleb the land on which he has walked. And it is written, they gave Hebron.
So we have other, thank you, we have other verses in Scripture later on that talk about the fact that Caleb, is given Hebron as his portion for his family to live in. Why? Because that's where he walked. When did he walk? In this a little bit obscure, enigmatic text, this mysterious text that says, they went to the south, but he went to Hebron. He went to Hebron. Who's he? Caleb. Why did he go there? Who was buried there? The cave is there. The cave of Machpelah. The Machpelah cave is there. The cave of the pears. That is the cave that Adam and Eve are buried. Abram and Sarah is buried. Isaac and Rebekah are buried. And Yaakov and Leah. They are all buried there. Four major couples buried in Hebron. And it's a major, major, major place for prayer. Today it's a complicated place because of what's going on in Israel, unfortunately. But nonetheless, people go there, people live there, and it's a very special place to daven. So Caleb goes there to pray that he be saved. So Joshua was blessed by Moshe, Yeshua was blessed by Moshe, but given a new name. And Caleb, he was also spared, he was also one of the two good spies, because of his prayers to... upon the graves of the patriarchs. Now, make sense so far? Fine. So 12 spies, 10 are rogue, 2 are good, and each one has their own avenue of blessing. Now we need to pick up the narrative. Still in the Torah Studies text, what happens? We read about the report. The spies come back. 10 of them say, the land is wonderful, milk and honey, here are its fruits. However, people are strong, cities are fortified, all the enemies are there. Now, they didn't conclude. They didn't finish their statement by saying, there's no way we can do it. Before they're able to give their grand conclusion, because they're setting up, right? The land is great, but the people are giants, the cities are all locked down, can't get in, and even if you did, they're all gunning to kill you, and they're all these mighty nations. The conclusion that they're pointing toward is to say, we can't do it. There's no way. It's a suicide mission. They don't have a chance to finish it because Caleb jumps in and he silences them. Right before they're going to give their big finish to say, there's no way we can do it, right before he does that, the spies collectively, Caleb jumps in and says, not so fast. Take a look at this text. Text 4a. Text 4a, page 191. Hey, Mike Sr., the elder Mike, please read. Text 4a.
Your Royal Highness.
Yes, all right. What was I thinking?
Caleb silenced the people to hear about Moses, and he men who went up with him said, we are unable to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we.
So, wait, before you turn, so no one turned the page yet, hold on. So what happens is, again, understand, it's important that you know the dialogue. The spies, 10 spies, they've gathered, it's interesting, Moses sent them. They don't come back and report to Moses. They come back and report to the entire nation. They call a press conference, and they invite everybody there. Already, that's a red flag. If you get sent by the commander, right, to go on a spy mission, you come back and you report to the one who sent you. You don't hold a press conference and invite the New York Times and the Washington Post, and that's not what happens. If you call the media, if you call the people, you know that it's going to get ugly, right? You know that there's another agenda there, and that's You can right? It makes sense, right? Right there. So here's the deal. Here's the point. The point is that they call everybody together, and then they're leaning towards saying, oh, there's no way we can do this. We're never going to be successful. Caleb stops them. He interrupts them. And what does he say? It says, Caleb silenced the people to Moses, and he said, we can surely go up and take possession. In other words, he says, not true, we can do it. Before they say we can't, he says we can. And then a moment later, they say we're unable to go up against the people. They're stronger than us. How did Caleb silence the people? How did he jump in? 10 spies and a few million people that are panicking. How did he silence the people? Rashi explains. Mike Sr., please continue. Your Highness, please continue. Text 4b, 192. Rashi explains Caleb's incredibly clever silencing technique.
You can call him
Mike.
To Moses, to hear what he would say about Moses, he cried out, is this the only thing the son of Amram has done to us? Anyone listening might have thought that he intended to disparage him, and because there was resentment in their hearts against Moses because of the spy's report, they all became silent so that they could hear his defamation. But he said, didn't he split the sea for us, bring down the manna for us, and cause the quails to fly down to us?
You understand what's going on in the dialogue? Rashi explained exactly what happened. The spies are getting up and saying a negative report, basically saying that Moses and God are leading us to the slaughter. And then Caleb gets up and says, and he's one of the spies, he's the 11th spy, right? He gets up and says, and is that the only thing that Moses did? And everyone thinks he's going to pile on. They're like, yeah, give us more. Give us more dirt. What else did Moses do? What else can we get angry about? And he says, split the sea for us, right? Brought down the manna for us and caused the quails to fly down to us, gave us meat. Meat, bread, and dry land. And so Caleb says, Caleb pulls the old switcheroo. He says, is that the only thing? And then he gives three of the miracles. And that's how he silenced the people. Now, did it work? It didn't really work. I mean, for the moment, he quieted them down and he got in his point. But then the spies, resumed their negative report and their conclusion. They said, we can't do it. And the people cried. And God still gave the decree of 40 years of wandering. The point, though, is that Caleb, on some level was effective, at least in the fact that he silenced the people and got them to hear this message. Now, it didn't turn around the whole situation entirely, but nonetheless, it was a little bit effective. Yes? You with me? So I want to ask a few questions. Oh, before we do that, Mike, please read text 4c as well, page 192. Rashi continues, because if you look at the verse, which is 4a, the Torah itself says, Caleb silenced the people to hear about Moses. What do you mean to hear about Moses? Because he said, you want to hear more about Moses? And then he gave good stuff. And he said, we can surely go up. That's the first thing he says. We can surely go up. And Rashi explains, what does that mean?
Even if Moses would tell us to make ladders to ascend to the heavens, we would be successful.
Alo na'ala. In the Hebrew, it's we can go up, we can go up, we can surely go up. There's no doubt we can go up and up and up and up. And Rashi says, what does it mean? He was saying, not only can we go up to the land of Israel, even if Moses said to do the impossible, to build a stairway to heaven, we could still do it. Let alone this mission to conquer the land of Israel. So that was his point, that we can certainly do it. I'm going to ask now 5 questions. 3 questions on what we just read, 2 questions about Caleb, about another verse that we're going to read in a moment. 5 questions, then we're going to reconstruct this whole story. So question number 1, why is it that Caleb, okay, We know there were 10 spies that had ill intentions and 2 spies that remained true to God and Moses with belief and faith that God could pull this off and that they would be successful. Caleb and Joshua. We discussed the origin stories, right? So, yeah.
Just, maybe, would you be willing to elaborate on the bad intentions at the get-go?
Yeah, it seems that the 10 spies that came back with a negative report, it seems like they had an agenda from the beginning to come back with a negative report. That's the implication that the commentaries say, based on how, based on all the evidence, they saw all the miracles, and they left Egypt. They were there at the splitting of the sea and at Mount Sinai and the golden calf. I mean, they saw all the stuff that had gone on the last year or so, 2 years. So they were not unaware of that. And if they came back with such a negative report, it seems like somehow they had negative intentions from the get-go. Now, was it literally devious, or were the negative intentions just in the sense that they were under the impression or they believed that they were more important than they really were? Let me explain. Moses didn't ask them for an assessment of whether or not this is feasible. That wasn't the mission. It wasn't, do you think we can do this? That wasn't a question, do you think we can do this? God already said we're doing it. It's not a question of feasibility. The question is the best way to do it. Check it out. Which cities are weaker, which are stronger? Where do the people live? Give me an assessment, not of the viability of the whole project, but give me your best assessment of the way to go about it. The fact that they came back and gave their conclusion, we can't do it, means that they went in with more thinking that they were more important than they really were. In other words, the question of whether or not we're going to do it was not riding on your shoulders, 10 spies. Right, people? If we're speaking to the 10 spies. That's not what you were asked to do. You're not that important that you're being asked to decide whether or not we're going to end up in the land of Israel, fulfilling the promise of God's promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's not on your shoulders. You just tell me how, not the what or the why or whatever it is. Just tell me the how. So they came in with negative intentions, maybe not the worst intentions, but at least some sort of intentions that weren't exactly aligned with what they were sent to do. So even on a very basic level, again, the fact that they came back with a conclusion that we can't do it, if that's not what you're being asked to do, then that's inappropriate to speculate on. Okay, so that's, yeah. Moses gave it to them. Yeah, they were chosen. No, that was true. That was true. Yeah, no, yeah, they, and they also saw death and destruction everywhere. A lot of funerals. And God did that so that people would be busy burying their dead and not notice these 10 non-giants, Jewish-looking fellows walking through. It's like, what? We were wearing a baseball cap. Who would have ever thought that was us, right? It's like you ever see like the Hasidic people with the, yeah, like in Vegas, like at the thing, but with a baseball cap. It's like, oh, I had no idea that you were there. I mean, you just blend totally right in with everybody else. Baseball cap threw me totally off. Anyway, yeah, certain things you just can't. I mean, whatever. Okay, maybe if everyone is. Yeah, exactly. And that's really the point. The fact that they came back with that means that on some level they were looking for, to whatever extent, they were looking in the wrong direction. Okay, so we have 2 of the spies that remain kosher. They remain faithful. Here's question number one. Who silences the people? Why not Joshua? That's question number one. If Joshua, if Yeshua was also righteous and also faithful, why is it that only Caleb silenced the people? And you could answer, well, one of them had to do it, and that's fine. But my question is, why Caleb and not Joshua? We don't find that Joshua decides to step in and try to derail it. He doesn't try to stop this from happening. Only Caleb does. Why Caleb?
Well,
question number one.
Caleb was like more verbal and Joshua was more of a warrior?
Maybe. I don't know. Well, we have a different answer. It could be. I don't know their personalities. But the question is, why Caleb specifically? Question number two. Question number two is, how did Caleb actually get the people to be silent? Even though he said, And this is, you think this is the only thing that Moses did. He did more stuff, and they thought he meant more bad stuff or more juicy stuff, more juicy gossip. And that's why they were silent. Nonetheless, it seems to be pretty remarkable that this guy, this one individual, could get the entire ruckus to kind of be silent, to hear him speak. How was he able to get that type of, to command that type of silence to at least allow him to deliver his message, even if it wasn't taken 100%? That's question number two. And question number three is, Caleb cites three specific miracles. He says, is this the only thing that Moses did? Moses did great miracles for us. He split the sea. He gave us the manna, and he gave us the quail, the meat. Why specifically these three miracles? Why didn't he say Moses did the ten plagues and Moses ascended the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights? He could have cited other miracles that Moses had done through God or had effected for the Jewish people. Moses helped turn the bitter waters of Marah into sweet waters, right? So what happened over there? Why specifically these three miracles? Question makes sense? Yes? So when Caleb tries to bolster or kind of boost the reputation of Moses, he cites, according to Rashi, three specific miracles. Why these three specific ones? So again, three questions. Let's recap. Number one, why Caleb, not Joshua? How did he command attention from the people? And the third, why does he cite these three specific miracles? So to understand this, we need to ask two more questions on another verse. The verse is a few verses later in our narrative, and this is found text number 5. Sarah, please read this, page 193. This is as God is kind of talking about the aftermath, and Hashem says that as a consequence for the people not believing in me and in my ability to take them into the land, so this generation will not enter the land of Israel. They'll die out in the 40 years of wandering, with the exception of two people, Joshua and Caleb. Even Moses was going to die. Only Joshua and Caleb from the men, only Joshua and Caleb, they're the two individuals, the only two, that would survive and enter the land of Israel in 40 years' time. But look what the Torah says in text number 5. So this is how God talks about Caleb not being subject to this decree, but rather he can go into the land. Two questions, or maybe more. Number one, why does God call Caleb my servant? Avdi Kalev. Avdi Kalev, what a weird expression. My servant Caleb? Why does he call him my servant? Why not something else? My servant. Yeah, he was faithful, but why servant? We're all servants, fine. But so why is Caleb singled out as a servant? Number one. And number two, what does it mean that it says, when it says, since he was possessed by another spirit? What's this possessed by spirit? Was there an exorcism that happened? Show me the way. You know The Exorcist? That movie? You know The Exorcist? Have you ever seen it? I've never seen it. I do not plan on seeing it. But The Exorcist, the director, who I think is Jewish, so he filmed a real exorcism. Well, okay, he filmed an exorcism somewhere in like South America. Yeah. And he's putting it out or something. Something like that. I just thought I'd mention that. Being possessed by spirit. Recently? No. Just like in the last month or two.
There was a Yiddish play called The Dybbuk.
The Dybbuk, yeah.
Many moons ago.
That's a Jewish spirit situation. Have you guys ever heard stories of the Dybbuk?
The name is familiar, but...
Yeah. Or Shindalids? Oof. Yeah, it's a whole thing. We used to hear these stories around the campfires. Yeah, we used to go camping. You hear these stories? No? But it's a perfect campfire story. Everyone's gathered, little kids, there's tents, you're outside, and it's like, you know, this person suddenly one day begins speaking in a weird voice. Ah! You know, it's just all this interesting stuff. Listen, it's fun. Or it's not. But yeah, the Dybbuk, that was, it was a book. It was a play.
Can you give me just 2 seconds?
Dybbuk is a, Dybbuk means cleaved. I don't know why it punched, but it means cleaved or attached. When something attaches, so it's a spirit, usually a wayward soul. I know, right? I don't know how much of this we believe in, but this is what, you know, Jews have been around and they kind of picked up things, I think, from other other philosophies, other faiths. But anyway, the Dybbuk is a soul that for whatever reason did not find peace or, you know, a place in the hereafter that then finds a live host to kind of attach to and sort of torment. Huh? That explains it. Yeah, kind of like that. That's the legend of the Dybbuk. I can't vouch for it. I'm just saying. That's kind
of
like the exorcism thing.
Are there many of them? Or is
it just... I don't know that it's a thing. Are there many plays? There's one play. I don't know if it's a real thing. I just know that it's a... Okay. Now, so what does it mean? Again, 2 questions. Why is Caleb called my servant? And what does it mean that he was possessed by another spirit? Mike, you had... your. Okay. Good. No, just I thought I heard something.
But I can explain why he was why he said my servant.
Yeah, why?
Because he was willing to do whatever Hashem wanted him to do without he knew it would be okay. He didn't worry. About
but Joshua also. Why specifically Caleb? Joshua was also Caleb is singled out. Joshua was also faithful to the mission. Why is Caleb single? He's the only one that interrupts the people or that silences the people, and he's the only one that's called my servant. Why is he called my servant? Okay. So now we start getting some insight. The Aruch Chaim, who was a mystic and a biblical commentary, so the Aruch Chaim HaKadosh, he explains this in text 7a. Who are we up to? Adina Malka. Adina Malka's triumphant return to Torah studies. Do 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 do. Bam bam bam. All right, 194, text 7a.
Okay, and my servant Caleb, it is puzzling why is only Caleb mentioned and not Joshua. The words possessed by another spirit are also puzzling. What is the meaning of this
Okay, we're going to jump right into 7b. We're going to give you lots of text, Adina Malka. You're going to make up for lost time.
Yes.
And I want to tell you what the Aruch Chaim is going to say. What he's going to say is that Caleb, unlike Joshua, Caleb faced a fierce challenge in this whole story, in this whole saga. He was afraid, like the others. Joshua, he was faithful from the beginning to the end. He never doubted. Caleb, he could have gone either way. Take a look. Let's read this text 7b. This is not my commentary, right? We're learning the Aruch Chaim's interpretation, and it's going to open up a lot of insight for us. Text 7b.
What is intended with the words that Caleb possessed another spirit? Is that the very reason why he is deserving reward? Is because he possessed a spirit that can be labeled other? Caleb was at risk of being tempted by his base urges. Along with that, the negative influence of his peers caused a negative other spirit to rouse within him. Proof of this is the fact that he went to prostrate himself on the graves of the patriarchs.
In other words, he felt that he was in a precarious situation, vulnerable. So he said, I need a daven for my own clarity. Continue.
This then is what is intended with the words another spirit, a negative spirit. Nevertheless, and he followed me, namely, he followed the will of God as opposed to his own personal inclination. The verse uses this precise language. Inasmuch as there are 2 counsels within every person, a negative one advocating evil and a positive one advocating goodness and walking in the ways of God. Caleb chose the latter. God's reaction is in line with the Talmud statement that one who has the chance to commit a sin and is spared therefrom receives reward as though he had performed a mitzvah. Joshua did not have this quality, for he did not possess an opposing spirit, seeking to sway him from his intelligent path, for Moses had prevented that. Thus Caleb merited the title servant of God.
Akin
to Moses. Peace unto him.
Thank you.
But I don't understand what that...
Where, the Moses part?
Yeah.
Moses prevented Joshua by changing his name. Before he sent him out, he changed his name from Hosea to Yehoshua, which means, Kal Yoshiach Metzat Meraglim, may God protect you from the council of the spies, which means that Joshua was protected. He had been given this kind of spiritual fortress of protection to ensure that he wasn't going to fall prey to the fear and all of the... you know, the workings of the spies. But Caleb wasn't preempted like that. So Caleb was frightened. Caleb was afraid. He also saw the giants. And he also saw the fortified cities. And he also saw all of the death and destruction and all the negativity as we spoke about before. So Caleb was frightened. He was afraid. And part of Caleb, I don't like the translation. He says the Yetzer, his inclination, the other inclination, was working in overdrive. Here is translated as he was tempted by his base urges. It wasn't base urges. Base urges sounds like something else. It wasn't base urges. It was fear, straight up fear. He was afraid. His Yetzer Tov, his good inclination said, believe in God. And his natural inclination said, run like hell. Right? I mean, that was his natural inclination. Get out of there. Right? This is dangerous. Right? His fear sensors went up. It's like, this is not a safe place.
Oh, that was such a test.
This was a major test. This was a major test. And he felt like he's going to fail this test. So he went to pray. He got a little bit of help, and at the end of the day, he fought against his fear, and he said, I'm not 100% certain, you know, I'm afraid, nonetheless, the right thing to do is to believe in God, and that's what I'm going to say. I'm going to advocate for the position of believing in God. Fundamentally, although there were two spies that remained aligned with God and Moses, fundamentally, those two were in different spaces. Joshua never had a doubt. He never had to fight against himself. Caleb, had a fight against himself.
But it
means that, like in Kabbalah, we call it Sitra Achra, means the other side. It means the side that opposes holiness, the other side opposite holiness. Mm-hmm. Same thing is here. It says Ruach Acheret. There was another spirit. What other spirit? A negative spirit in him. He had a negative spirit within him. He had doubt. He had fear. He had a sense of not believing 100%. You know, in this feasibility. And therefore, God says, number one, so now all the questions are answered. So number one, that's why Caleb is singled out, why God calls him my servant, Caleb. Because he deserves some credit for mastering his own fear. Joshua didn't have to work at it. So what kind of servant is it if you don't work? Servant, avodah, implies effort. So Caleb put in the effort. Now why is it like Moses? Did Moses put in effort or was he a tzaddik? I don't know. I don't want to talk about Moses. I have a question. Why does he liken it to Moses at the end of that text? But let's leave that aside. The point is that Caleb, unlike Joshua, Caleb had to work for his faith. He had to work for his sticking to the mission. And it was hard work. So therefore, God says, Caleb, I'm giving you a special reward because you're my servant, you were possessed by another spirit, and still you followed me. That deserves a special shout-out in the Torah. Make sense?
A shout-out.
Right. Let's give a shout-out. Casey Kasem. Right? Here's a shout-out to Caleb for mastering his... Right. Okay, so now we can also, let me just round that quickly and then we'll get right back. I know Marnina has a question as well. So let's just round this out very quickly. This answers our other questions. So we answered, what does it mean, another spirit? A negative fear. Okay, why is he called my servant? Because he had to master that fear. Why is he singled out as opposed to Joshua? Because he had to master his fear, unlike Joshua. Joshua had it easy. Why was it that Caleb silenced the people and not Joshua? That was our original question.
Because the people feared.
Because he could relate to the people. Joshua would be like, why are you guys afraid? It's like, dude, easy for you to say. Right? You need someone that knows you to affect you. Right? You're impacted more by someone who sees things as you see it and then can reframe it as opposed to someone who never saw it through your eyes. Mm-hmm. Right? Who is more adept? Who is more apt at changing your mind? Someone who knows what you're thinking or someone who has no idea what you're thinking? Someone who knows what you're thinking, right? Someone who's been there, who's walked in your shoes, said, look, guys, I've been there. I know how it feels. I was also afraid, but let's believe. God can do this. Let's do this. Let's make it happen. That's more powerful than Yeshua getting up there and saying, hear ye, I've never been afraid. Don't be afraid. It's like, I can't relate to that guy. We're afraid. So you relate more to someone who also saw things like you saw it. Make sense? So that's why Caleb silences the people and not Joshua. And that's also why Caleb got the place quiet. Because people realized that he was relatable. Someone who is like in a different world, not relatable, it's like, yeah, whatever. It's not, yeah, the guy will get shouted down in a second. Even before he talks, you can sniff him out that he doesn't get you. It's like, you're afraid, and someone who's not afraid, it's like, okay, thank you. Thank you for your advice. You know, someone says, hey, why don't you, like someone who's feeling sad, right? Someone who's feeling down. It's like, hey, you know, cheer up. It's like, thank you. It's like, I'll do that next, right? But someone who speaks to you from a place of relatability, someone says, look, I know what's going on, and this is, you know, he starts off saying, you know, this is the only thing that Moses did. There's other things. Nonetheless, Moses also did this. Like, the way he starts off, it's not only bait and switch. They also sensed a relatability in the words of Kalev and Caleb. So again, that answers all five questions, maybe six. I'm not sure. I'm still not sure about five or six questions. So Caleb is singled out in praise and reward because he had to fight against his own fear. Caleb is referred to as someone who possessed another spirit, and that's what he had to fight against. Caleb is the one that specifically silenced the people. He got up there because he could relate to them. They were quiet because he could relate to them. Oh, it doesn't answer the fifth question yet. The fifth question is, why did he specifically mention those three miracles that Moshe did? Split the sea, give the manna, and give the quail. Why those three specifically, and how does that address the topic at hand? Right, you're with me? We're up to so far in this discussion? Everything else makes sense so far? Let's get to a few questions. Bernie. Okay.
No, I just wanted to hear that explanation again about how Moses had prevented, when seeking to sway him from the intelligent path, for Moses had prevented that. You were talking about...
Yeah. Yeah, so before, right at the beginning, when Moses appoints the 12 spies, the Torah tells us that before they left, Moses changed the name of Yehoshua from Hosea to Yehoshua. His name wasn't originally Yehoshua. What is Yehoshua? It's an extra yud, but what it does is it puts a yud in front of the hey of Hosea's name, Yehoshua, so it becomes yud and hey, which is God's name. So it's now his name now stands for a message. Ka, which I'm saying ka, it's, I don't want to say God's name with the yud sound, with a y sound, but it's right. So it's ka, Yoshiach, Me'atzat Meraga, may God spare you from the council of the spies. That's what Moses... So Moses prayed and blessed and shielded Yehoshua from the council, from the advice, from the direction of the spies. So he was... And why did he do that, by the way? Because Joshua was going to be his successor. He couldn't... And he knew that. He couldn't have his successor mired in this... if Moses, especially if Moses sniffed out that maybe these guys would think of themselves as too important, as more important than they really were, or a different task than they were given, as I mentioned before, especially if that was the case, Moses is like, well, there's one guy that we need to for sure protect, and that's Yehoshua. He has to stay because he's the successor. He knew that. Caleb, though, he fought for himself. He fought for his own integrity. Joshua was protected outside, you know, outside force. He was waterproofed, whatever that is, right? You know, he was right, scotch-guarded. Caleb fought for every inch that he acquired in that context. In other words, he fought for his own spiritual integrity and his faith and his belief, and to overcome the fear that he had, and therefore he had another spirit, but he overcame. He's my servant. He's blessed. He silenced the people, and he was the one that could command their attention. Now, Caleb's message. Let's focus specifically on what Caleb said. So he says, is this the only thing that Moses did? Ah, he did more things. What did he do? Split the sea, gave us the manna, and gave us the quail, gave us the meat. In these three statements, Moses addresses the source of their fear. Understand this. The spies and the people were afraid of this journey into Israel. They were afraid. They were crying. We can't do it. Why are we being sent to do this? It's not going to work. They were afraid. Why were they afraid? So the Rebbe explains they were afraid specifically about three things. And you can find all three fears embedded in the language that the spies come back with right before Joshua silences them, right? We read this text. I think Ray read this text right at the beginning. Right before Caleb says, wait, is this the only thing that Moses did? Right, and he throws in the three miracles. The spies say, okay, the land is nice and here it's fruit, but however, right, remember that however? However, dot, 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 here's the downside. In the downside of the land of Israel, they mention, the spies mention three things. And those three things are three sources of fear and apprehension about this. And therefore, Caleb counteracts these three specific areas of fear by citing and referencing three specific miracles that Moses brought about. Are you with me on this? Yes? Yes-ish? I'm giving you the outline, the structure. I'm not explaining it yet. This is the outline. So again, the people are afraid, and Caleb is trying to get them not to be afraid. I was afraid, he says, but don't be afraid. Let go of the fear and embrace the mission. But I know, he says, that you have three specific areas of fear. Therefore, I'm telling you, look at recent history. All three fears can be allayed by looking at three specific miracles that Moses helped bring about. Right? So what are the three fears? And how do the three miracles address it? We're about to jump into that. But first, I'm going to tell you something else. These aren't just the fears of the spies and the ancient Israelites. And these aren't just the miracles that Moses did that helped these people or might help these people get over their fears if Caleb got his wish. Didn't really happen, but if Caleb was truly effective, then that would have happened. They would have gotten over their fears based on these three miracles. It's not only a story that happened then, it's also a message for us in our fears, as we'll soon see. When we are afraid of something, it typically falls into one or all, or more than one of all of these three categories. There are three sources of fear that existed then and that are universal fears. And when I say fear, I mean if you're embarking on a new job or a new venture, a new direction in life, if you've lost something, you need to pick up something anew, whatever it is, anytime that you might encounter fear, so it will likely fall into one of these three categories. Caleb understands it, he gets it, he was there, and he addresses it by citing three miracles. It addressed their concerns, it addresses our fears today. You with me on this? I'm giving you the structure, the format, the skeleton of what we're about to do. So now let's jump in. What are the three areas of fear? To understand this, we're going to once again reset the words of the spies and see what they said to cause the fear amongst the people. So now we're up to text number 8. We already did this in the Chumash, but let's do it now in the Torah Studies pamphlet or books. Page 196, Steve, please read this. This is where the narrative of the spies turns from being a great land to being a source of fear.
However, the people who inhabit the land are mighty, and the cities are extremely huge and fortified. And there we saw even the offspring of the giant. The Amalekites dwell in the south land, while the Hittites the Jebusites and the Amorites dwell in the mountainous region. The Canaanites dwell on the coast and alongside the Jordan.
I want you to identify in these few lines, what are the three areas of fear on a very practical level? What are the three delineations of fear or of apprehension here that the spies are trying to deliver to the people?
They're surrounded. There's no safe place.
Okay.
Three
what else?
Enemies.
Okay.
Defeat.
Defeat. Okay, good. What else? They're stronger than you. The cities are fortified. Good. What else? Who thinks they know what where the three things are? It's not easy. It's not necessarily intuitive, but see if you can tell me where is the first source of fear. What is the first source of fear? What's number one? The spies are saying, "Be afraid. Be very afraid." Why? Number one. Okay, we're small. They're big. Okay.
The cities are huge and fortified.
Is that the same thing or a different thing? And the giants? Okay. So the way the Rebbe explains it, the first 2.5 lines are all category number one. The people that inhabit the land are mighty. The cities are huge and fortified. We saw the offspring of the giant. All of that falls into the same category. In other words, the task is too difficult. It's too momentous. Look, I could do many things, but not this. You're asking me to do this? I can do a lot of things. Give me someone else's job in life. Give me someone else's challenge or mission in life, and I'll do that. Everyone has an easier life. My job, I have to go against the mighty land, the fortified cities, and the giants, right? How am I going to do this? There's no way. My task in life is too difficult. You ever say that? You ever have that thought? That if I only had something else to do, it would be easier, but I have this to do, I can't do this. It's like, of all the things, God, that you could give me, you gave me this, the one thing I can't do. You ever have that thought? Even if you didn't, just humor me here. Right? So the point of this is to say, right? Mike's like, yeah, absolutely. Now, yeah, for sure. Totally. All the time. It's like on a daily basis. Right? So fear number one is not that I'm afraid of anything. No, I'm not. Other things I wouldn't be afraid of. Other things I would be, I would take on, head first or whatever it is. I would be very, very active in taking it on. But this specific thing, this specific mission, it's impossible. You gave me something impossible. What is this? Give me something else. Give me something I can do. You gave me... Look, you're stacked, God. You're stacking the deck against me. You're giving me, right, everything at once. You're giving me strong people, fortified cities, and children of giants, and you want me to go in? How? How exactly? How exactly am I going to conquer them? When they're strong, the cities are fortified, and there are giants roaming around. They can step on me accidentally and not even notice. Forget about a war. It could be like a sneeze and I'm out. Like, seriously. What is this? So this is symbolic in life of somebody who says, look, I'm not afraid in general, and I don't doubt in general, but this challenge is too big. This specific one, and it's usually the one that's yours. That's the thing, right? It's usually yours. And you usually say, well, someone else has it easier. Why don't they have this challenge? Because it's not your challenge, so it's easier. You with me? Mm-hmm. We always try to live other people's lives because it's easier. But our challenges are the ones that we need to conquer. But they seem the hardest because they're the ones that challenge us. Someone else's Yetzer Hara is not our Yetzer Hara. You with me on this? Someone else's challenge or vice is not ours. So it's like, why can't that person just get over that? Like, that should be so easy. And God, why don't you give me that? I would totally master that. And we say, no, you have your own challenge. And that challenge is really hard. And so the person might say, look, I don't like this challenge. I refuse to accept this challenge. I'm afraid of this challenge. This is the one that I can't do. And this is specifically the one that I have. I don't like it. So that's number one. Number two. Again, it's not necessarily intuitive, but I wanted to see what you guys came up with. So this is the way the Rebbe explains it. Number two, the second fear. So the first source of fear or apprehension is simply, I can't do this. Other things I could do. This I can't do. Number two is Amalek. The Amalekites. They used a trigger word, right? You know, they have these trigger warnings now on campus, safe rooms and trigger words. It's like, oh, Amalek, oh, right? The Jews were frightened by the word Amalek. You know why? Because Amalek was the nation that attacked them right after the Exodus. And again, multiple times Amalek attacked them. And it wasn't always a pretty battle. So as soon as the spies say, you know who we saw there? Remember Amalek? That's where they live. On their turf. It's not them now attacking you on the road and you can, you know, repel them. This is now going into their strongholds. Good luck. On a very basic level, they were triggering the fear of the Jewish people. But the Rebbe explains it a step further. How did Amalek have the ability to initially challenge the Jewish people? Rashi explains, based on our sages, that it's because the Jews took the divine protection for granted. The Jews said, oh, we're safe in the desert, we're safe from Pharaoh and from Egypt. And they started believing that maybe it was them, and they forgot a little bit about God. So God said, okay, you want to forget about me? Fine. Amalek is going to attack, and you'll see soon that you need me to protect you. And that's indeed what happened. So what does that mean? Amalek is not only a trigger word for an enemy that has a history with you, but Amalek, more than that, in a spiritual sense, Amalek represents the sense of feeling not worthy of that success. In other words, the Jews doubted God's protection, and that's why Amalek attacked them. And so they had made a mistake by doubting God, and that's why they got attacked. So remembering and recounting Amalek would perhaps evoke within the Jewish people a sense of shame and a sense of disappointment in what they had done in the past of allowing the enemy to attack by not fully believing in God. In other words, it would evoke a sense of lacking, a sense of sin, a sense of shortcoming of the past impacting the present. And again, psychologically what this means is sometimes we are paralyzed. Not necessarily with the task at hand. That's step number one, right? That's fear number one. Fear number one is I'm paralyzed by how big this task is. Okay. Step number two is I'm paralyzed by my feeling of unworthiness. I don't feel worthy. I don't feel capable of doing this. In other words, it's not that I don't feel capable of taking on this challenge. I don't feel worthy. It's like somebody who said, I'm trying to think of a good example. We do this all the time. We put ourselves down and we don't think that we're worthy of something great. So we set our sights low. So somebody says, hey, why don't you try this? Me try this? I can't do that. Not even thinking about the challenge, but just thinking about myself not being capable or worthy of that and the success that that might bring. Does this make sense? Right? Somebody who says, you know, I'm not going to open up my own business, you know, because whatever, X, Y, and Z. This is not a good example, but it's maybe an example. Maybe an example. I don't know. I'm not sure yet. I'm just thinking it through now. But somebody says, no, I can't. Not because it's too difficult, but because, you know, it's almost like we shortchange ourselves from the success. And I'm not saying that having your business equals success. I'm not saying that. But it's like somebody who says, I can't do this, almost because it's a self-defeating narrative of I can't do it. I don't grant myself permission to have that type of happiness. And
is it like when you say somebody asks me something about education, and it's such a slippery subject, so sometimes I might say, who am I?
Right. Who am I to tell you? Right. And some of that might be fear of being the one that people go to. Right? It might be a fear of the fear of being the expert. But in a sense, so that's all. That also paralyzes us. That also stops us from becoming the expert. Because who am I to be the expert? Who am I to be the scholar? It's like, who am I to be the religious one? Not only what are others going to say, that's also part of it. But it's, do I allow myself, do I allow it for myself? Am I worthy? Or do I kind of like, oh no, that's not me, or I can't do that because, you know, I'm not such a right, like I'm not that person. Who says? So it's this narrative of self, of who am I, that gets in the way. And again, I know the connection between that and Amalek may be a little bit tenuous. I try to explain it, you know, the best that, not the best that I could, but in a decent way. Again, Amalek attacked, according to the commentaries, because the Jews didn't believe fully in God. Which means that the Jews, in looking back at the war of Amalek, might have felt that they were attacked because they had sinned. They had fallen short. They were unworthy. And that might carry forward in feelings of inadequacy and unworthiness. Of if we were unworthy then, maybe we'll be unworthy in the future. Maybe we won't be successful in this mission. Not because the mission is too big, but because we are unworthy or unrighteous and undeserving of that type of success. So again, what holds? What are the inhibitors? What are the paralyzers? What holds us back? What holds us back? Number one, we've done two out of three. Number one is, this mission is too difficult. This mission in front of me is way too difficult, number one. Number two, I can't do it. I'm not worthy. I don't deserve it, etc. I can't cover myself. The third one is fascinating. Karen, I'll get to you in just a second. The third one is fascinating. The third one is the Hittites, Jebusites, Amorites, and Canaanites, all these other nations that are on the periphery. What it means is, this is the third thing that paralyzes us. You know, the mission itself I could do. The fact that I can do it, that I deserve it, that I'm worthy, I acknowledge I'm worthy enough that I can achieve the success. But there's another issue. There's so many other details involved until I get there. Oh my gosh, so many details I need to do. Like, it's not, if it was just conquering one thing, if it was just one thing, I could do it. But you know what it takes to get there? It's like this whole series of challenges and steps in order to even get to what I need to get to. So there are all these other nations lying in wait along the way. Forget about what lies in the final destination. Forget about the challenge itself. That was point number one. Let's say I'm over that. And what about I can't do it? Let's say I'm over that. But the third thing is, if it was just one thing I could do, but it's a whole series of things along the way. Who says I'll be successful with all of the things that it takes to even get to the place that the final challenge lies? Those are the three areas of fear, of inhibition, of doubt, of questioning that paralyze us and might stop us from embarking on our mission to enter the promised land, so to speak, and get where we need to get to. Remember, the story of the spies is not just once upon a time, these people didn't want to go into the promised land. It's we also don't allow ourselves or don't embark on the missions that are critical to us. Because either A, it's too difficult, the mission is too difficult, or two, who am I to do this mission? Or number three, there's so many other details, I can't do all these things. Right? These are three points. And each one is answered by one of the miracles that Caleb cites. Number one, God split the sea. You know what happened by the splitting of the sea? The Jews were standing in front of a sea, and all they could see was the sea. Right? There's a new book, Sea, Split. You know, Sea, Spot, Run?
Sea,
Split.
Sea.
It sounded better in my head before I said it. Anyway, so they were facing a sea. And that is a formidable enemy. That is a challenge that cannot be overcome. So a person says, yeah, I can't do this. Give me something else. I can't do this. The Jews would have also said, we can't do this. What do you want us to do? There's an Egyptian army there, and there's a sea here. We're stuck. We're done. We're finished. And yet, God split the sea. Moses was part of that. And the sea split. In other words, even when you say, my challenge is too big to bear, I can't do... It's not even I can't. This can't be overcome. Challenge number one, this can't be overcome. Comes along the splitting of the sea and reminds us, yeah, this too can be overcome. Number two, I'm not worthy. Moses says, if they change the order a little bit, Moses says, look at the quail. The Jews asked for meat. Remember last week's class? Right? Should they have asked for meat? No. Remember, they shouldn't have asked for meat. They had their own animals, and yet they asked for meat. They asked for it. They didn't deserve it. And still, what did God do? God provided. Which means that God provides even when we're unworthy. So you tell yourself, I'm unworthy of the miracle. I'm unworthy of the success. So what? God still loves you. He'll still give it to you. Even when you tell yourself, I can't do it because I'm unworthy, why would I be the one to be successful? Who am I to be successful? God provides miracles even for those that are unworthy. So again, we have two answers now. Number one, this is too big. God also split the sea. But who am I? I'm undeserving. God also provides for the undeserving. But what about all the other things along the way? There's not just this and not just me. There's 1,000 steps along the way. Okay. God also provides miracles along the way. Namely, the manna. The manna from heaven was the food that God provided through the journey in the desert, not in the promised land. Even on the way to the promised land. You with me? Even on the way to the promised land, God is providing food. Now I know what you're thinking. Of course God has to provide food along the way, because if he didn't provide food along the way, how are we going to survive? If there's no food along the way, you can't get to the promised land. The point is, that's irrelevant. It's not irrelevant, but that's beside the point. The main point is, it's not only God did a miracle when the challenge was right in front of them, God also did a miracle, the everyday little miracles, in order to get them to the big moments. God gave them food every single day until they got to the sea. God gave them food every single day until, well, I don't know if they had the manna before the sea. I have to look at the timeline there. But either way, God gave them food every single day, bread from heaven, until they got to the land of Israel. And so what Caleb was telling the people is, number one, no challenge is too big. Number two, you're not unworthy. Even if you are, God will still provide. So don't worry about it. And number three, all the details, all of the steps along the way, God too can and will provide a miracle just like he provides the manna. Let's read this inside as the Rebbe explains it, and then we'll close it out. Oh, yeah, let's close it out in a moment. Text number, what do you say? Hold the question. Let's wrap it up, and then we'll take all questions. We'll let folks go. Text number 10, page 198. Dan, we're up to you.
In response to the spies' claim that, quote, the people who inhabit the land are mighty, Caleb responded that by splitting the sea, the situation called for a war that was naturally unwinnable.
So that was the first claim. It's not possible. Don't worry, God also split the sea. Continue, please. Even when we're making trouble, God still loves us, right? I'm unworthy. I don't deserve it. Look what I've done in my life. Do I really deserve this? Doesn't matter. God will still bless you. He still blesses the people with meat. Continue.
In response to their claim, quote, the Hittites, the Jebusites, on the side of the Jordan, Caleb evoked the manna.
That's the manna, yeah.
The manna.
Yeah.
The manna?
The manna, yeah.
The entire sojourn of the Jews in the desert was a technical auxiliary thing, a path to get to Israel. Nevertheless, God still provided the Jews with manna, clear proof that God provides miracles, even for matters that are only, quote, on the way to the goal.
So there we have it. Three lessons for them then and for us today. Number one, no challenge is too big for us to overcome with God's help. Number two, even if we think we're undeserving, give yourselves a break. Let's let ourselves off the hook. God still loves us. He'll still provide for us. The miracles can still happen. And number three, even all the details that seem to be standing in the way as well, even with all the details, the auxiliary details, God still provides miracles, even for matters that are only, quote, on the way to the goal. So there's another text, the text 11, and there's a text 13 as well, which we're not going to read these. But you should know that the Rebbe basically brings it around to Caleb, and he says Caleb was afraid, as we saw in the Arachaim's commentary. Caleb at some point was afraid, and he overcame his fear. See, he represents the type of person that is afraid and nonetheless gets the job done. These are the meditations that he used for himself. Three meditations. Number one, no obstacle is unconquerable. Number two, I am worthy. And number three, God is always in the details. And with these three meditations, he was able to overcome his own inhibitions. I once heard that John Wayne said the following. Was John Wayne a real person? He was. Yes? Okay. John Wayne talked about a hero, I think. And I'm misquoting him, and that's fine. And it's probably not John Wayne. So maybe, you know, whatever. But something along the lines of a hero is not someone who's not afraid. A hero is someone who's afraid and still gets the job done. Something like that. We can Google it after the class to get the exact language. Have you heard this before? Something like this?
Yes.
Again, a hero is not someone who was never afraid. That's Joshua. It's not a hero. That's like a tzaddik. It's like an angel. It's like he's out of the conversation. A hero is somebody who's very afraid and who still gets the job done. Still pulls up the cowboy boots. I don't know, I'm thinking John Wayne, right? But gets the six shooter. It's been a while.
Six shooter.
Right? Spurs on the boots. Right? Kicks open the door. Right? Tumbleweeds blowing. And that's it. And stares down the source of fear. And in this way, we can all be heroes. Heroes in the sense that we get the job done and do what we need to do. So may we be inspired by this week's Torah portion, by Caleb's bravery to stand up to his own fear and to conquer it. And may we conquer our own fears and achieve our destiny and reach our promised land. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for Torah Studies.